Whether it's obesity, the funding of food stamps, food insecurity, the quality of school lunches, food labeling requirements, salmonella outbreaks, and the use of GMOs, food is always in the news. But they aren't solely food issues. They're political issues. For this week's Food Fridays Please Explain segment, Mary Nessel is here to help us navigate the politics of food. Ms. Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, and the author of a number of books, including Food Politics, Safe Food, What to Eat. Her most recent is Eat, Drink, Vote, an illustrated guide to food politics. It's published by Rodale. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. We also invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. And you can also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And I love saying that you are the Paulette Goddard Professor of Department of Education, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, what is she, her name? She was a great actress and married to a great, her last husband was Eric Maria Remarque, if I remember correctly, All Quiet on the Western Front.
Well,
what is her name doing on a Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health?
Well, when she finished with Charlie Chaplin and Burgess Meredith and moved on to high intellectual circles, she traveled in those circles in New York, had no children, and left a lot of money to NYU. And the story, which I adore, is that she left it in the form of baubles. And so I like to feel like my title is the result of some leftover jewelry.
Food issues seem to have been getting more attention in recent years. Has food always had a political component in this country, or is that a relatively new development?
Well, I think it's always had a political component, if I guess the place where it's just a question of whether you noticed it or not. And certainly the food safety issues at the beginning of the 20th century were pretty hot, and that was when the Congress passed the first food safety laws. But I think what's happened in the last 20 or 30 years is that the food supply has gotten so overabundant in food that marketers really have to push hard. And the politics have just gotten more and more intense, as they have everywhere in this country.
It's interesting that the reporters who dealt with those food issues at the beginning of the 20th century were called muckrakers. And now
they're called business reporters.
Yeah, but now we hear about muck in the food in some cases,
yes,
like that pink slime stuff. We sometimes hear the phrase, vote with your fork. What does that really mean?
Well, I use that phrase a lot as shorthand for if you want to change the food system, you have to put your money where your values are. And if you buy at farmers markets or if you buy organically grown food, you're voting with your fork for the kind of food system that you want. And if everybody did it just a little bit, it would make a big difference for the producers of those foods.
Although, as I can guarantee you that right now somebody is typing on a comment page, yeah, if you have the money.
Yeah, if you have the money, and that's where the politics comes in. Why is it that fruits and vegetables are so much more expensive relative to junk food? That's a political issue.
Because often low nutrition foods are subsidized, but high nutrition foods are not?
They're not. We don't subsidize fruits and vegetables. And the Department of Commerce has data that say that the index price of fruits and vegetables has gone up by 40% since 1980, whereas the price of beer, soda, and butter has gone down by 30 or 40%. So there's something wrong with that picture. And we don't have an agricultural policy that supports health policy. It would be really nice if they were linked.
We have covered the ways that the Supreme Court's ruling on Citizens United has affected how politics is conducted nowadays. We've done a number of segments on the show. Has it affected food issues as well?
Oh, absolutely, in exactly the same way, because food industries are like any other corporation. They lobby, they give money to elected leaders, and they're very eager to make sure that nobody says anything that might indicate that you'd be healthier if you ate less of their products.
So the lobbyists are determining what we eat?
Well, the lobbyists have a great deal to do with determining federal policy, for example, and this is totally rumors, and I can't really back this up with data, but almost everybody I know who works in federal agencies dealing with food says that they have been very slow to release regulations because the lobbyists are on top of the White House all the time. And they're just unable to budge as a result. I can't, you know, vouch for that, but that's what they tell me.
Well, I remember years ago when a standard was being set for organic food, and this was during the Clinton administration, and the Secretary of Agriculture was willing to allow all sorts of things that we probably wouldn't consider to be organic, to be labeled organic. And there was a big outcry, but that was largely because of pressure from lobbyists.
Well, yes, because big agriculture wanted to be able to put whatever they wanted on foods and call it organic. And
well, now they say natural.
Oh, yeah, the natural problem. Biotechnology industry and the grocery manufacturers have just written the FDA asking to have genetically modified foods labeled as natural. That'll be fun. I wonder what the FDA will do with that.
My guest is Marion Nestle, the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Her latest book is Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. It's published by Rodale. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. In this country, we often talk about the obesity problem, which seems to be worse here than in practically any of the other industrialized countries. Do we know why?
I'm not sure it's worse here. I mean, there are a lot of industrialized countries. Yeah, we don't have any restrictions on what food companies can do to market their products. Other countries have some restrictions on marketing to children, and those seem to be associated with healthier weights. Where the obesity problems are really enormous is in developing countries.
Well, in Mexico, where there's real concern about obesity, they are now controlling the way soft drinks are made.
Well, they've just passed a tax on soft drinks, and and Chile has just set nutrition standards for advertising. Ecuador has done the same thing. The Latin American countries are very concerned about rising rates of obesity. Mexico, 70% of the population is overweight. And that means that there will be very high rates of type 2 diabetes. That's a big government expense.
Well, obesity may be a problem here, but so are hunger, food insecurity, and food waste. And I was wondering how all of these things can occur at the same time. Some of them seem contradictory.
Yeah, we love contradictions in this country. I mean, they're all part of the food insecurity problem is a function of the rising gap between rich and poor in this country. And it's so ironic that poor people are now more overweight than wealthy people, but that's what we're seeing.
Unhealthy foods are less expensive?
Yeah, because access to food is more difficult. I mean, if you tell people that they need to eat more fruits and vegetables, they have to be able to get them, they have to be able to pay for them, and they have to be able to cook them.
Well, food stamps have long been the way to ensure that poor families are able to access enough food. But the Senate has cut food stamps funding by $8 billion. And the House has gone them even better and cut it by $40 billion. Either way, that represents severe cutbacks. What's your take on this food stamp debate?
Well, that's the current politics for you, is pay the rich, you know, have food assistance for the rich in the form of what happens with agricultural subsidies, and take it away from the poor. It's kind of weird.
Well, some people argue, critics of food stamps, that people can use food stamps to purchase soft drinks and junk foods. Do you think there should be restrictions on what people are able to buy with food stamps?
Well, I actually do, but that's not really the point at this point. At this point, the objective has to be to make sure that we don't have people starving on the streets, and let's deal with what the food stamps do afterwards. I started out thinking that you shouldn't put any restrictions on what food stamp recipients could buy. But over time, I changed my mind. And I changed my mind mostly when I saw how much food stamp money is spent on junk food and how much junk food manufacturers and retailers benefit from food stamps. And I see this at my local drugstores that have put in just a few little foods that meet the requirements for accepting food stamps. And then there are signs everywhere on the processed foods, the sodas, the TV dinners, all of the things that are, you know, are not necessarily tremendously healthy, that say we accept EBT cards. So that they're advertising and encouraging food stamp recipients to buy these foods. So I think we could rethink that, but this is not the time to do that.
And then there are people in Congress who are calling for drug testing or job training requirements for people who receive food stamps.
We're not very nice to the poor, are we, in this country? You know, welfare.
Did you read about the congressman from Georgia who suggests that kids who get free school lunches should be sweeping up the lunchrooms as a way of paying for them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very cruel society that we're living in these days. I mean, welfare policy has always raised questions about the undeserving. It's the assumption in all of these things is that the poor are less deserving than we are. But certainly to blame this on children seems terribly unfair. These kids had the bad luck of being born into poor families.
In the past, didn't we share some of the excess, the extra cheese and other products with poor people? We may have forced them to go into humiliating situations to get that cheese. But,
yeah,
but are we still doing that?
To a much, much smaller extent. Most of food aid now comes in the form of cash transfers through these electronic benefit cards, and the those surplus foods, a lot of them go to food banks if there is any surplus food.
Last week we spoke with Paul Solotaroff about an article he wrote for Rolling Stone called "The Belly of the Beast," about the conditions that exist in most factory farms, and the situation is horrifying. Listeners wrote in to talk about how upset their stomachs were for a show like that at lunchtime. But is it just the demand for cheap meat that's led to animals being raised in these crowded pens entirely indoors, given drugs in their food to help them get fatter quicker?
Yeah, it's money and politics. If Americans demand cheap food, we have one of the least expensive food supplies in the world, not only because there are so many rich people, but also because of deliberate government policy to keep the cost of food low. And it's hard to argue against cheap food because we have so many people who are having problems feeding themselves and getting enough to eat. But the cheap food pressure has put pressure on producers to cut every corner they can.
And now the FDA is talking about banning the use of antibiotics in animal feed. But if the animals are kept in these tight situations, won't that mean that more of them will be getting sick?
Well, you would think so. I mean, it will really require meat producers to use much better animal husbandry, which they would just as soon not bother to do. But the antibiotic situation has reached crisis proportions. Something has to be done about it. And the FDA's tentative toe in the water on that one, which is voluntary and it doesn't have to be done for 3 years. And there are lots and lots and lots of loopholes. But the industry certainly is looking at the FDA's action as a step in the door. And a step towards banning these antibiotics, which most health professionals think ought to be done sooner rather than later.
Mayor Bloomberg's record on public health stands out as his term is coming to a close. He banned trans fats in New York 7 years ago. Now the FDA wants to ban them nationally. He also wanted to cut down on the size of soft drinks. And there was an outcry every time. People were calling it a nanny state.
The nanny state, yes. I guess it depends on who you want making your decisions for you, whether you want the food industry making the decisions based on marketing objectives or whether you care about public health. We have a food environment that greatly encourages people to eat more than they should. And a 16-ounce soda is two standard servings and contains all of the sugar that's recommended for an individual in a day.
Why do you think soft drinks remain so popular?
People like them, and millions and millions and millions of dollars go into advertising them every year.
But
I
wondered about the supersized soft drinks. If you wanted to have a lot of soft drink, could you just buy two?
Sure, with no trouble at all. But everybody knows people won't. In general, people eat what's in front of them.
What about the trans fats? Why are they so unhealthy?
They raise blood cholesterol levels, the bad blood cholesterol levels, a little bit more than saturated fat. They're artificial. They're unnecessary. They're easily replaced. I think they're a no-brainer and should have been banned a long time ago.
Well, government bans all sorts of things that it deems bad for us.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of drugs. I can't buy heroin or cocaine, for mm-hmm. example. In some states, I'm going to be allowed to buy
marijuana
if I
yes.
want it. But even then, it's regulated rather tightly.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think there's such a public outcry when we talk about controlling things like trans fats or high sugar content?
Well, I actually didn't think there was much of a public outcry over the trans fat because they're so easy to replace at relatively low cost. And the New York City Health Department did a very, very good job of preparing the groundwork for that one. I think it's just the kind of political situation where we're in now, where there's a big anti-government sentiment, and people don't think that government is acting in their best interest. It's often not. It's acting in corporate interest. But it's hard to sort all of that out. A lot of people have trouble figuring out what that's about.
My guest is Marion Nestle, Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, author of a number of books, including Food Politics, Safe Food, and What to Eat, and also a monthly Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle blogs, and also blogs. It's called foodpolitics.com.
It is.
And you
almost
tweet at Marion Nestle.
I do.
And the latest book is Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, published by Rodale. We will continue our conversation, take some of your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or read your comments. You can write to our show page or to us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We are back with today's Please Explain segment with Marion Nestle of NYU, author of a number of books, including most recently Eat, Drink, Vote, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics. And that's what we're talking about today, food politics. And we are inviting your calls at WNYC.org. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And Joy on Twitter asks, what do you think of Walmart as an answer to food deserts in some poor areas?
Well, I wish that Walmart did a better job of selling healthier foods. We don't have Walmarts in New York City, so it's hard for me to check in on them all the time. But I do see them upstate and go in and do research periodically. And I'm not impressed either that their fruit and vegetable prices are any lower than any other supermarket.
They have introduced some organic foods.
They have, and I wish the quality looked better. I mean, I don't know what to say. If there are two supermarkets right next to each other in Ithaca, which is the one that I go to, the Wegmans stuff looks a lot better, and it doesn't cost much more.
A listener asks, fact or fantasy, Nixon and his Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, worked to get sugar out of food and led the switch to HFCSs. I'm reading it, had to do with our control of the sugar market versus control of the corn market.
Oh, I think it's really a matter of cost. High fructose corn syrup is so much cheaper than sugar, especially in the United States, where sugar prices are are artificially kept high through tariffs and quotas. Certainly in the 70s and 80s, you could get high fructose corn syrup for about a third of the price of sugar. And this led lots of companies to adopt it instead of sugar.
Let's take a call from Peter. Hi, Peter from East Elmhurst. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious to know. Well, first of all, I just want to say I love your show, always, every day as much as I can. Anyway, I'm curious to know. My two boys go to public school in Queens, and they really do not like the school food. Do you have any knowledge regarding the nutritional value of the food in our schools?
Yeah, if the school that they go to has federally supported school lunches, then they need to meet certain nutrition standards, whatever the foods are that do that. If they don't, they don't. What kind of a school do they go to?
Well, they go to public school, junior high one and high school the other, and they just don't want to eat the school food. If they question their friends about it, just out of curiosity, they all say the same thing. It's just, you know, some of them say it's gross, they don't want it, it's not good. You know, I just want to know if it's encouraging to the brain to have the kind of food that the kids are eating in school these days. Is it really, does it have good quality nutritional value?
Yes, it has nutritional value. And what I would say about the fact that they don't like it is, and I've been to a lot of schools in New York City, and in some of them the food is absolutely delicious. It smells good when you go in the cafeteria, and in others it doesn't.
Well, Bill Telepan, who's a wonderful chef, works in a program to supply meals to the schools, and we've done things with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he also talks about how little you can spend on each student. I think it's a little over $1 per lunch. You really have to be very clever in coming up with stuff that is going to taste good and be nutritious.
You have to have a school in which the cooking is done from scratch, and in which the principal, the parents, and the teachers, and the school food service people all believe that cooking for kids is really important.
Well, the USDA schools.
There are schools like that.
The program from the USDA serves 12 million students a year. The school lunch program serves nearly 32 million children. But is it true that ketchup and tomato sauce and pizza are considered vegetables in those programs?
Yes, and for this you blame Congress. The Department of Agriculture rules wanted to get tomato sauce off of pizza as counting as a vegetable because there wasn't enough on there. And the makers of pizza for school lunches went to Congress and lobbied and got Congress to pass a law that said that the Department of Agriculture could not set volume limits on tomato sauce on pizza. Thank you very much.
We've also heard about hamburgers made with pink slime and other examples of food made with low-quality ingredients served in schools. Now, why would we give our children pink slime?
Because it's cheap and meets nutrition standards. Once again, that I believe is now up to the schools to decide. But if there is a school that cares about what the kids eat, the food is good. There are lots of schools like that. I've seen them. And let me say one other thing about the congressional intervening in the Department of Agriculture school food rules. We have a Congress that can't pass a farm bill, but somehow they were able to pass a regulation micromanaging USDA's school food rules. Pretty amazing.
Now, why do you think it's been stalled in Congress for so long? It's not going to pass this year.
It doesn't look like it, absolutely, because it's so political.
But it's the most important food-related policy our government has.
Yeah, it's in a bill that's impossible to understand. It has so many different programs in it, no legislator can possibly understand it. And it is so open to lobbying that they just can't budge on it.
Well, isn't the big problem in this farm bill food stamps?
It's only one of the big problems. There are several big problems, but that's certainly the biggest because 80% of the funding of the farm bill is food stamps. And there were very, very good reasons for putting, political reasons for putting food stamps in the farm bill in the first place in the 1970s. And now they are inextricably linked because there aren't enough votes to pass farm supports, and there aren't enough votes to pass food stamps. And up until now, they would log roll and vote for, okay, I'll vote for this if you vote for that. It's not working anymore.
Well, I would think that the people in Congress from farm states would be anxious to have a new bill put in place.
You would certainly think so. But the farm states are the Republican states. They're the red states right down the middle of the country.
And they're the ones who are holding up.
And they're the ones who are putting in stipulations on food stamps that nobody else can accept.
Well, farmers benefit from food stamps, don't they? It means more people buying what they produce.
Well, they get maybe 2 or 3 or 5 cents on the dollar, on the food dollar. The retailers get most of it, and that's why the retailers are for it and the food companies are for it, but the farmers lose out.
Is it Nainine from Staten Island?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. You're on the air.
How are you? Thank you for taking my phone call. I guess one of the things that I feel that can combat this issue, meaning, you know, the inequality in food and all that stuff, is starting conversations with kids. I had a really great conversation with my six-year-old son the other day about, you know, that big behemoth that is, I don't know if you can say the name of the restaurant on the air, can you?
Sure.
Of course you can.
McDonald's.
You mean McDonald's?
Yeah.
And Burger King and Wendy's, yeah.
We figured
well,
that out.
Well, specifically McDonald's, he looked at the sign and he's like, oh, Mommy, look, it looks like french fries. I'm like, yeah. Now, I raised him, he's a vegetarian, so we don't go really in there. And he said, you know, how come we don't go in? So I actually gave him the reason why I don't go in and why, you know, I don't take him in. And then he looks at me and goes, but why is it so open? And I was like, wow, that's a great question. And I told him why they're so open and, you know, the reasons I thought it was so open because it's subsidized, because people are addicted from a very early age. And kind of going to the point of what you were talking about is why do people still eat the stuff, drink the sodas? Food is inextricably linked to our emotions. You know, we're told this is good. This is going to be, you're going to be the cool guy if you drink this. You're going to be the cool girl if you eat this.
Well, do you think that part of the problem is that we just are rather ignorant about nutrition?
No, I think we're ignorant about marketing. I mean, most people feel like marketing doesn't affect what they eat at all, and yet the food industry puts $30 to $40 billion a year into trying to sell its products to everybody, including very young kids. And what we're not is media literate in the sense that it's very difficult, certainly for children, to tell the difference between entertainment and advertising.
Nicholas from Tuxedo, New York, you want to add to this?
Yes, actually. That was my comment. By the way, I listen all the time. Thank you for taking my call. If you walk down the cereal aisle in any supermarket, you will see that most of the characters that are on the boxes are looking down. Their eyes are pointed down, and that is trying to target little kids walking by the aisle because they look up, and they want to see that these children are making eye contact with, you know, the characters on these boxes of cereal. And most of the times, these cereals are very high in fats and carbohydrates and things like that. So, I mean, that's another reason why I believe marketers are pretty much one of the keys to this whole problem.
Well, Marion, you used to recommend that people shop along the perimeter of the supermarket.
Don't set foot in those aisles. And if you're buying cereal, you go up to the top shelf, which is where they put the boring, healthy cereals.
But the perimeter is where you get the vegetables and the dairy and the meats and the stuff that you actually might need to eat.
Yeah, that used to work. It doesn't work so much anymore because supermarkets have figured out that everybody figured that out. So now they're putting the junk foods in the middle of the produce section.
This week, Danielle Molloy, the governor of Connecticut, signed a bill that requires labeling of foods that contain GMOs. And it's the first state to do so. We could talk about GMOs and the controversy surrounding them for a long time, but do you support labeling?
Oh, absolutely. I was on the FDA Food Advisory Committee in 1994 when the FDA decided that GMOs couldn't be labeled. I thought it was a very bad mistake. They didn't listen to me, what can I say? Because I thought it would make consumers not trust the products, and consumers have a right to choose. And the you know, it's a long story why that didn't happen. And the big surprise to me is that it's taken this long to get the public riled up about it.
Well, polls indicate the public still thinks GMOs are okay.
Well, they may think they're okay, but they still want them labeled. I mean, I don't think the issue of okay or not okay is really involved. What's involved is people should have a right to choose.
In 2010, Congress passed the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act. What did it do? Was that a good thing?
I think it's a very good thing. It hasn't done anything yet because the rules are just coming out. There's a couple of them are gone into the final rule stage, but most of the rules have just started being issued and are gradually being introduced and modified. The FDA has just backtracked on some rules having to do with produce because they didn't work out very well and nobody could figure out how it was going to work for them. I think it's going to take a while to sort it out. But once it's done, it ought to make for a much safer food supply.
Well, can't the FDA collect fees from companies it inspects as a result of this? Is that a good idea?
I think it's a terrible idea.
Because it creates a conflict of interest?
It creates a terrible conflict of interest. And the, you know, I was on another, I was on the FDA science board when that one was being discussed. And it was my first meeting, and I thought, oh, no, we're not going to talk about this now on my first meeting. And I said, you know, there's a conflict of interest here. And they said, well, the NIH does it. I said, but the NIH isn't a regulatory agency. You're a regulatory agency.
In recent years, there have been contaminated peanut butter, chicken, ground beef patties, packaged salads, pomegranate seeds, and yet there doesn't seem to be much call for added regulation. Is there enough regulation in power just not being enforced, in place, not just being enforced, or do we need more regulation?
Oh, we absolutely need more regulation. I mean, we know how to produce safe food, and if companies aren't doing it, it's because they don't have to and nobody's monitoring it. I mean, we have enough evidence by now that unless you have one of these preventive plans in place and it's really carefully designed and monitored, that too many accidents will happen. I don't think it's that companies want to poison their customers, but they sure aren't careful and not about preventing it.
But we've been talking about politics in food, and yet the politician seem to not be all that interested in serving the public interest.
Well, food safety isn't something that engages people. In the same way. And I've always said that the only thing that would get Congress to act on food safety would be if the child of some very important senior senator got sick.
Marion Nestle.
And I don't want that to happen.
Paulette Goddard, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, Public Health at New York University. Her latest book is Eat, Drink, Vote from Rodale. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
My pleasure.